Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Ryan Lara Show on WNYC, and did you know that this is Brain Awareness Week with events across the city highlighting the progress of brain research? And there's a lot that's driving our increased understanding of neuroscience, including art. And we are very happy to have the renowned performance artist Marina Abramović here in the studio. Her latest piece, Measuring the Magic of Mutual Gaze, builds on her work at the Museum of Modern Art a few years ago in The Artist is Present. She is also creating a new art and education center in New York. So welcome to WNYC. Nice to meet you, Marina Abramović.
Nice to meet you, and I'm really pleased to be here.
And David Popel is here, professor of psychology and neuroscience at NYU, here to talk about what the neuroscience community can gain from these art projects. Welcome to WNYC. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us here in the studio is Susanna Dicker, a researcher at NYU, who has worked with Marina Abramović on the performance piece Measuring the Magic of Mutual Gaze in performances in Europe. And today she's helping us run our own brain study during this interview. Welcome, Dr. Dicker.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can't see this, but we will tweet a picture of Marina Abramović and me in the studio as we talk. We're both wearing headsets with sensors on them. So, Susanna Dicker, what exactly am I wearing and why?
So you're wearing a wireless emotive EEG headsets that records patterns of electrical activity that's emitted by your brain. And then these brainwaves are sent to my computer, where I am going to compare your brainwaves to Marina's brainwaves, because what we are trying to investigate is what it means to be on the same wavelength, so to speak, and whether there's a relationship.
And will you be able to tell something about us during the interview and how we're connecting in conversation?
Possibly. I can tell you whether you're connecting a lot or not, because this comparison will give you a real-time index of your brainwave synchronization, and you can translate that into visualizations, and that's what we're going to do here.
So. And we'll come back and talk to you more about what it means and what you're actually seeing and what it means. But Marina Abramović, you used this technology, these same headsets, in Measuring the Magic of Mutual Gaze, which I understand came out of questions you had about your interactions during The Artist is Present. And I wonder if you could explain to our listeners how the two pieces are related.
You know, when I got this idea to be present in MoMA during my retrospective of 3 months, I didn't have no idea that I would have this kind of reaction on the public. So I have 1,750 people sitting in the front of me on any amount of time, everything between 15 minutes to 7 hours.
It wasn't timed? A patron could come and just sit there with you for any length of time until they chose to leave?
I especially didn't want to limit it. I want to be absolutely free from the participant to how much time he want to take. And I remember curator telling me that maybe nobody will sit in the front of me. It's New York. Everybody's busy. We are in the most speedy city in the world.
And we want our personal space.
Exactly. And that happened, real miracle. Not only that the people was sitting, but they was waiting. Waiting became part of the process. The people not just wait in the museum, but wait outside and sleep through the night and come to just to the sit in front of me.
No talking.
There was no talking. It was just about gaze. And that gaze, it really changed my life. There's something happened with this, you know, moment of, you know, looking to the person, complete, total stranger in the eyes. And the emotions that came out of this, it was so tremendous. I mean, almost 90% of people cry. They sit there for maybe a few seconds, sometimes 3 minutes, and they burst into this incredible emotional.
Why do you think they cry? Looking at you, a person they didn't know.
I could not tell this because I really didn't know all this, what happened. I could not explain that till actually the scientist got interest in me and told me why we don't do this experiment with mutual gaze and see what really happened with the brain. And this was, you know, my step to the science, because I didn't want to just to left on this, that maybe the art is just kind of hocus pocus of emotions, but must be something scientifically to be explained. Why do people have this need to show their feelings in New York, what people mostly don't do.
Now, listeners, we can take some phone calls. If you went to The Artist is Present at the Abramovich retrospective at MoMA in 2010, maybe you had an intense reaction along the lines that she's describing, and you have thoughts about what was going on in your brain. Call us. Tell us about it. Speculate, if you like. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or if you have experience with any art projects that use neuroscience, like this one, or perhaps The Ascent, which was in town last year. Did you see that? We're going to talk to the artist momentarily. Call in and tell us about that. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And let me turn to David Popel from NYU. These headsets that we're wearing seem so casual and so easy to use. It only took a few seconds for Dr. Dicker to put them on me and Marina. How does this compare to the work that neuroscience researchers are doing in a lab?
I mean, these headsets are actually pretty good. So it's a remarkable fact of how large your brain activity is that we can see it in the traces that are on Suzanne's computer, even though we just put on two, you know, relatively simple-looking headsets. What's a little different in a lab is that the experiments we do are very targeted and, you know, very crafted. Here, the idea is to have people interact very casually. The two of you are having a conversation, and we're trying to figure out what's happening between the two of your brains. Now, I think it's worth making a couple of distinctions here. Art is not science, and we do this. The artistic project has its own emotional valence. We do it for its own purposes. So it's an interesting fact that we can use this to answer some scientific questions, but I think we shouldn't confuse the two. The scientific projects we do in a very targeted way with very different kind of apparatus, and so we want to be embracing that we can do it together, but we want to make sure that they're not misidentified as the same thing.
But if you...
But I have to disagree. Because why I'm disagreeing about this? Because, you know, I don't think that you had any subject, the free volunteer, who can sit that amount of time like me, that actually you can experiment and make conclusions. So that means that you need certain stamina and energy to do that. So in a way, I am perfect subject to experiment.
That's right. You turn out to be a fantastic scientific subject for the study. But doing it in the context of the artistic project is a little different than asking a specific scientific question, right? So we shouldn't be limited by the poverty of the imagination that we have. So as scientists, we should, of course, take advantage of this fantastic opportunity of having you as a participant.
And so from a scientific perspective, what do you actually gain? What does the neuroscience community have to gain from engaging the public in this way? We could think about the emotional side of what Marina was just describing about what happened at The Artist Is Present. And we can, you know, think that, well, it kind of makes sense. There was an emotional reaction there by one person sitting and gazing into the eyes of another person in an evocative setting. What do you learn as a scientist from that?
Well, I think Marina's point is exactly right. It turned out to be a situation that was very rich for participants, very emotionally rich, and so we can now study this in a very targeted way. We can acquire a lot of data from the many participants that you saw, and we can now turn this into a very specific experiment in where we are going to learn how people interact in more naturalistic situations and not in these very weird tasks that we subject people to in the labs we have.
But can you actually see that the amount of subconscious information go from the one brain to another brain in that kind of situation when you're dealing with total stranger, that actually that could be a really interesting platform for analyze what is happening in the brain in that moment?
Yeah, I mean, that would be great if we could, but we can't, because that's a good but too hard question. The kind of data that we're getting from this, we can't actually analyze that. We don't know how the neural code works.
But that leads me to the new question. What we actually know about the brain?
Well, almost nothing.
That's a good platform to start.
Yes, it's a good... So we now... we should...
A lot of upside from that starting point.
No, I mean, that's... You know, of course, we have, you know, very important, rich knowledge from, let's say, 100 years or 2,000 years of studying the brain. But the fact of the matter is we don't know how information is actually stored, how it is that you suddenly retrieve an emotion in your head, how it is that you and I can have a conversation at all.
Well, let's hear a subjective telling of some of that from somebody who did sit across from Marina at The Artist Is Present. Denise in Manhattan is calling in. Hi, Denise, you're on the air. Whoops. Let's see. Debbie, could you put line 7 up for us? Forgive me. Denise, now we've got you. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. And I wanted to ask, Ms. Abramovich, I sat across from you and really appreciated the opportunity to do it. And, of course, I know what I was thinking, and we have some sense of what other people were feeling because we've seen their reactions. But my question is, what was going through your head the whole time? I mean, how did you manage? You know, we know what a physical challenge it was for you, but mentally or emotionally, what were you thinking? Like, we were trying to figure out what was going through your head. So I'm just wondering what emotions were you feeling as you did that?
You see, the sitting for me was really important, that every new participant come across opposite of me, sit in the chair, that I kind of clean my mind to the kind of zero state and to be absolutely in the present. And then just absorb the feeling coming from me, from the person I'm watching. So if the person have the emotions, different states of the pain, I will just absorb that. But I always keep my consciousness in the present. I didn't want it to go into the past or the future. Just be in that moment. That's what all my job was, and it was so hard to do. But that's what I was doing.
But were you
so
wondering,
not to think,
like, who
not
is
think
this
state.
Person? Who are they? Like, were you? What were you thinking about the person in front of you, or were you really just in your own head?
No, I was never in my own head. I was actually just observing and absorbing what kind of energy coming from that person. That was all my job. So I had very, very strong reactions to certain people and less strong to another ones. But to me, the eyes was a kind of door that I can enter to other person. So I was actually there unconditionally for them. I was not thinking anything else about myself or any other thoughts. Every time that will happen, I would try with my breathing pattern to go back into the present.
Denise, thank you so much for your call. Now, Dr. Dicker, as you can see, my headset is coming a little bit undone, but I'm curious. You're sitting here nice and patient and scientific. Are you gathering data from me and Marina right now, and what are you seeing that's worth talking about?
So as David already pointed out, you can't really say that much from, especially from like just the two of you right now. But one thing that I seem to notice is that when you're both listening to David, you're connecting more, and maybe at the end of when you're taking turns, you seem to be connecting a little bit more to each other. But again, we don't really know at this point. And I do, if I can, I wanted to respond to David like a little bit more nuanced, if possible. Like, obviously, these are art projects first, but I do think that there is scientific value to them, if only because what measuring the magic of mutual gaze, for example, arose from a collaboration between artists and scientists to try to understand what artistic and scientific questions would be interesting to ask. And we have now gathered a lot of data from people who have participated in this experiment/art installation, and we have some information that we can then use, for example, to ask further questions in the lab. So about what eye contact, for example, might do to two brains, because the research so far only focuses on direct gaze on a single brain, as opposed to what mutual gaze really does to possible synchronization.
And so, what practical application could it have? Marriage therapy, peace negotiations, what?
Well, the first thing that a lot of people say is that you could use these for dating purposes. And then, obviously, the second thing you have to say is that it's very important to keep in mind that we don't know what makes our brains synchronize. And so you can't really use it for this. But who knows, maybe 10 or 20 or 50 years from now, I don't know.
Well, I see that an art therapist is calling in, and it's Esther in Highland Park. Hi, Esther. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
A student art therapist. I hope that counts.
What? Say that again. You used to be an art therapist?
No, I'm just a student.
Oh,
I'm a student art therapist.
Okay.
So I'm learning.
It definitely counts. You're not a jaded professional yet.
Yeah. But one of the things that we learn a lot about is mirror neurons and how kind of doing art with somebody and really being present with a client and kind of like validating what they say and their expression and the art that they're making in the session can really help, like, repair attachment and create attachment and really help create, like, a stronger sense of self, because the early mirroring that the child and mother experience together is what creates, like, the ability to form attachments and to have a strong sense of self.
So... a neuronal, if that's the right word, analysis of the act of doing art.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very popular topic, and the appeal to mirror neurons is very popular. But I would urge you to take a kind of skeptical stance about that and not worry too much about the brain correlates of that. And, we read a lot of cues from just looking at each other and looking at each other's faces, and whether mirror neurons or not play a role isn't all that important. I think if I can amplify Suzanne's point for a second, I think the very exciting outcome of this collaboration of the mutual gaze is that you guys were able to turn an purely artistic project into a scientific experiment that answers legitimate questions about how the mind and brain work. The question that I have for Marina is, well, the data that come out of this, for instance, the data appearing on the screen, do they actually in turn have artistic value for you?
You know, this data for me is the platform for the new work. I don't know what I'm going to do with this and how we're going to develop, but I'm really wanted to more conclusive kind of research to then that I can study. But you know, I have so many questions. The art is sometimes to actually ask the questions, but not necessarily getting answers. One of the questions I have, I'm going to answer you with a question. And you know, I was always puzzled by the Dogon tribes in Africa, which actually they worship the trans Pluto, which is the satellite around the Pluto, who never been discovered till the really scientists find the telescopes strong enough to discover it. But they knew it is from the ancient time of the existence of this trans Pluto. So how you see in artists or old cultures, they have kind of intuitive knowledge, and then scientists don't believe till they really find the proofs. So that's some interesting thing. How that scientists are so cynical about everything. Why you just sometimes believe things without proofs?
I guess my question is to you: why are you so cynical and believe things without proofs? I think that there's a real difference, right? So I think in the sciences we try to find regularities in the world, in the biological or the physical world, and try to come up with explanations of things. If we should be so lucky to find a phenomenon maybe coming from the arts that enriches our understanding of the mind and brain through, let's say, in this case, empirical aesthetics,
but
that's
very
legitimate.
But you can't deny the phenomena who exist, and you can't explain them. Now we have the entire science based on brain, and we don't even know what brain it is. It's really mind-blowing. But what about telepathy?
One can study that. I mean, we have things like grants for synthetic telepathy. How can I read your mind and transmit the information to mind wirelessly, for instance? Is that possible? Is that even plausible? Look, just because we don't understand the phenomenon yet, though, doesn't mean that we shouldn't approach it maybe through the lens of the arts, maybe through the lens of the sciences. Those are different kind of glasses, right? They have different kind of resolution and different types of answers.
With us are the artist Marina Abramovich and the scientists Susanna Dicker and David Popel from NYU. And I mentioned earlier a performance art project called The Ascent that has been in several cities over the past year, including in this area. And joining us now for just a couple of minutes to explain The Ascent and its relationship to the conversation we're having is creator Yehuda Duenas, also known as XXXY. Hello, Yehuda. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, Brian.
So I haven't seen The Ascent, but I've seen it described as, quote, a mind-controlled levitation experience, end quote. Participants wear an EEG brainwave sensor, I guess somewhat similar to what Marina and I are wearing right now, and a harness. So, okay, what happens next?
So what you need to do is you need to get into completely present meditative state of mind. And when you do, you start affecting all of the sound and the light in the room. It's a very intense experience. And what it does is it starts to lift you up into the air. And the higher you get, the more intense it gets. So it's also like a high striker at a carnival where you hit the mallet and make the bell go ding. Only in this instance, the mallet is your mind. And when you get to the top, you win, and The Gates of Kiev by Mussorgsky starts playing, and the big sun comes out, and the confetti cannons go off, and you become immortalized in a spectacular moment.
And what are you hoping will come from this, and what does come from it?
We were very surprised by people's reactions to the experience, actually. It started with a lot of experimenting of how to get user control to a rigging system. So how can I have myself fly around a room? And so we were playing with all sorts of different types of controllers or interfaces, and I kept saying, I just want to think it. I just want to embody this feeling of flight. I don't want it to be a controlled interface. I want to just fly like a bird. So we started playing around with brain-controlled interfaces, and we played around with an emotive headset, with NeuroSky headsets, hooked them up to a rigging system, and had this levitation experience, and it was like Leonardo da Vinci meets Raymond Kurzweil meets George Lucas. It was completely unbelievable. And so what we were trying to do is just create an epic experience. But the reactions that we got far surpassed that. And people described near religious experiences doing it and feelings of, you know, satori, like temporary enlightenment. And we're still trying to figure out how to handle all of the different types of experiences that people had doing the ascent.
We're almost out of time, but Marina, you have a question for him.
Oh,
you two artists know each other?
Yeah, we don't, but we have to meet, because this kind of experience you're describing, I have very strongly in Artists is Present, when I really have out-of-body experience. And just last 2 months I spent in Brazil really exploring the incorporation of the spirits in different shaman traditions, and we are talking about the same thing. It's so much to do.
And Marina,
let's
just
have coffee, Marina.
Yes.
And no,
and
no,
let's levitate.
Yes, and yeah. No doubt you will have synchronous brain waves and Jedi mind melds, and you know whatever else you want to have. If people want to see your latest work, Marina, is this going to be done in New York, the Mutual Gaze one?
We are still planning different locations, not yet. I'm just working on something else at the moment. I'm opening my institute in Hudson, which have to be the institute for the long-durational performance art, anything to do between theater, film, the dance, the music, but have to be 6 hours and more. And public have to sign the contract to spend that amount of time.
The audience pledged to stay for the whole 6 hours.
Yeah, because time is everything. You need time to experience something. And the one thing in our life, we don't have time.
Up in Hudson, New York. When does that open?
We're trying to open end of 2014.
Okay.
And we need donations, because we need money to do that.
And we will have to leave it there. But this is Brain Awareness Week, and you can find a link on our website to a lot more information about events going on in the area. Go to WNYC.org for that, and you can also find a video of the brain activity recordings from our conversation today. That's my brainwaves and Marina's, just what you always wanted, a video of my brainwaves. So we thank very much Marina Abramovich, Professor David Popel of NYU, and Dr. Susanna Dicker of NYU. Thank you all. And I'll also mention that Dr. Dicker will be running a lab at the Museum of Natural History this weekend for kids, and there's a link to that information on our website as well. Thank you all very much. This has been so fascinating.
Bye. Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a professor from Rutgers Law School on his new book, The Rule of the Clan. That's clan with a C, by the way. What an ancient form of social organization reveals about the future of individual freedom. Stay with us.